Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. My name is Dr. Charles Geschke, and I'm serving as your host for the evening. Tonight's program is part of a series underwritten by the Geschke family, which examines the U.S. Constitution in the 21st century. It's my pleasure tonight to introduce this evening's speaker, Lawrence Lessig, director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University and author of the book Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Dr. Lessig is a noted intellectual property rights and internet policy expert. He has spent much of his career focusing on law and technology. He founded the Creative Commons Project as well as Stanford University's Center for Internet and Society. He's a true visionary and author of several books. Professor Lessig co-founded the Change Congress Movement, a national effort to build support for basic reform, reduce corruption, and diminish the influence that money has brought into our government functions. Currently, the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law at Harvard University, Professor Lessig has clerked for Judge Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. He serves on several boards, including Creative Commons, MapLight, AXA Research Fund, iCommons.org, and has received numerous awards, including the Free Software Foundation's Freedom Award, the Fast Case 50 Award, and was named one of Scientific American's top 50 visionaries. Please join me in providing a warm welcome to Professor Lawrence Lessig.
Thank you. I'm extremely happy to be here tonight, extraordinarily honored to be introduced by one of the co-founders of one of this Silicon Valley's greatest companies. It's wonderful to be home. We spent 9 amazing years in Silicon Valley when I was at Stanford, and it was everything I could do to keep my wife at home with the children because she was very keen to come out here. But I will report that it's raining and horrible out here, so she won't do that. So I have just one sacred text. There are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil. Henry David Thoreau, 1846, on Walden. There are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the root. So imagine a letter from a young woman. There were 2 clocks regulating our life, the one on the wall and the one in the bottle. And we built our life around those clocks. He slept late in the mornings, so mornings were bliss. We could play and laugh without fear. But at some point he would awake, and soon after he awoke, the bottle was opened, and then as the day grew older, the day grew more terrifying, too. He was happy at first. Just before dinner, he was the most happy. That is the only time I spoke to him, a moment to pretend I had a father who had a feeling of love. He'd smile, he'd laugh, but soon he would grow irritated. And by the end of dinner, he was angry. And if we were not gone, usually just hiding in our room by 9, he would be violent. He hit me more than once. Once he tried to do something worse than hitting me, and then I left, and I never went back. We struggled to do many things in that house, to keep food in the house, to keep winter out of the house, to keep the house. But we never even spoke about getting him to stop. I don't know why. The bottle was just part of our life. We learned to live with it. Anything more just seemed impossible. Now, it's the thing about us, we humans, that we adapt, we adjust, we learn to live with it until we can't. And when we can't, a certain kind of fever breaks out and we need this Thoreauvian moment. A moment where we stop hacking at branches of evil and start striking at a root. A moment when we become a root striker. Okay, so there is a feeling, I suggest, among too many of us today, too many of us Americans, that we might not make it. Not that the end is near or that doom is around a corner, but that the distinctly American feeling of inevitability, of greatness, culturally, economically, and politically is gone, that we have become Britain or Rome or Greece. Now, a generation ago, Ronald Reagan rallied the nation to deny a similar charge, Jimmy Carter's worry that our nation had fallen into a state of malaise. And I was one of those people so rallied, and I still believe that Reagan was right. But the feeling that I'm talking about is different. It's not that we as a people have lost anything of our capacity, but that we as a republic have, that our capacity for governing, the product in part of a constitution that we have revered for more than two centuries, has come to an end. The thing that we were once most proud of, this, our republic, is the one thing that we have all learned to ignore. Government is an embarrassment. It has lost the capacity to make the most essential decisions, and slowly it dawns upon us that a ship that cannot be steered is a ship that will sink. This is not a Democratic or Republican point alone. This frustration is genuinely multipartisan. The idea that this government doesn't work is cued for us from many individual blockages of policies on both the left and the right that get stopped by a system that systematically stops change in our government. And at a moment like this, we need the reflection to find this Thoreauvian root behind this problem. Now, my job tonight is to brainwash you a little bit about what that Thoreauvian root might be. So I'm going to give you three examples. Let's start with one that was my life out here for just about a decade. Issues around copyright. I became a copyright activist on October 27th, 1998, when President Clinton signed into a law a statute in honor of this great American, the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. This was a statute that extended the term of existing copyrights by 20 years. And the question that Congress was to ask as it passed that statute was, would it advance the public good to extend the term of existing copyrights by 20 years? Now, copyrights, of course, are monopolies handed out by the state to create incentives for people to produce great work. In theory, handing out a longer copyright term for work that's not been created might induce more creativity. But the one thing we know about incentives, at least in this universe, not Star Trek's universe, but in this universe, is that incentives are prospective only. Not even the United States Congress can get George Gershwin to produce anything more. So when Congress asked this question, it should have had an obvious answer. And when we challenged their statute in the Supreme Court, we got a bunch of economists, including this liberal left-wing, this is Milton Friedman, right-wing Nobel Prize winning economist, to join a brief asserting that this could not possibly advance the public good so long as the word no-brainer was somewhere in the brief. So obvious was it that this statute could not advance the public good. But obviously there were no brains in this place when Congress unanimously passed this extension. What there was more than $6 million in campaign contributions from companies related to the Disney Corporation who would benefit from this extension despite its harm to the rest of society. Well, here's another example. Think about Wall Street. We've just seen extraordinary collapse on Wall Street. which triggered a collapse in the economy around the world. What explains that collapse? Well, according to Quack and Johnson, in this extraordinary book, 13 Bankers, we can understand the collapse as the kind of product of a perverse mix. Mix of both too little government and too much government. Too little government in the sense of deregulation. In the 1990s, we saw an explosion of financial innovations, what we call derivatives. These innovations, though, were invisible to the marketplace because through a series of changes in law, derivatives were exempted from the traditional transparency rules that apply to every other financial asset traded in financial markets. So, as my colleague Frank Partnoy calculated, in 1980, 98% of the financial assets traded in the market were traded subject to these traditional rules of transparency and anti-fraud requirements, rules that were given to us by the New Deal. But by 2008, because of this deregulation movement, 90% of the assets traded in our economy were traded absent any obligations of transparency or an obligation to be traded on a public exchange or even an obligation to be subject to anti-fraud requirements. That radical change produced this shadow banking market, which in part encouraged the bubble, which when it burst helped to bring down our economy. But Quack and Johnson say that alone wasn't enough. In addition, we had too much government. Throughout the 1990s, the federal government had a clear beacon that it sent to people throughout the market, a kind of government guarantee that when this bubble burst, there would be a bailout at the other side, producing what is technically the dumbest form of socialism ever invented by man. We socialize the risk, but privatize the benefit. They get all the upside, we get all the downside. Now, I know this is not an audience of lawyers, and I'm going to use a technical legal term here, and I apologize for that, but this is an insanely stupid way to run a financial system. And all of that stupidity, of course, was just before 2008. After 2008, the stupidity only increases, right? After 2008, we have a kind of insult added to injury, which is the standard behavior of our Congress, because after we had seen the biggest collapse since the Great Depression, after those who were independent of Wall Street identified at least a major cause of that collapse being the mismanagement in regulation that had led to derivatives being outside of the traditional restrictions of markets, including liberals and conservatives. Judge Richard Posner wrote two books that identified this mismanagement of financial regulation as a significant cause. And after the dean of deregulation, the Ayn Randian Alan Greenspan, head of the Federal Reserve, confessed to Congress that he had made a mistake expecting that the banks would behave decently instead of behaving in a way to get as much money as they possibly could. After all of that happened, still, Wall Street had the capacity to blackmail our Congress, to give them essentially a get-out-of-jail-free card, and to leave the essential structural flaw in our banking system where it was. If before 2008 the problem with our financial system was that banks were too big to fail, after 2008 that problem is only worse. Now, why is it? We would have this repeated combination of mismanagement by our government. Well, lots of possible reasons, but here's the one thing we know. The largest segment of campaign contributions to Congress and the fastest growing campaign contributions to Congress before 2008 came from the financial sector and the securities sector. And in the 2010 congressional election, the largest section by far comes from finance and insurance. Okay, here's one final example. I'm sure many of you, when you saw these pictures of the Deepwater Horizon, had this nagging thought at the back of your head. How was it that such an experimental drilling platform could have been permitted without extensive environmental impact and risk studies being conducted? mean, after all, in my part of the country now, we spent 9 years and 10,000 pages to get environmental authorization for a clean energy project. So exactly how much investigation was done of the Deepwater Horizon before it was permitted to drill in its experimental depths? The answer is 17 pages before it was exempted from any further environmental impact review. Now, when Congress heard this, Congress was shocked.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
Yet, of course, it was Congress that had required these fast-track approval processes. And when we ask why would Congress do that for something as dangerous as these deep-water drilling platforms, there are lots of possible answers, but the one thing we know is the endless stream of campaign cash that drove to that conclusion. Now, no respectable liberal or libertarian or conservative could defend these cases. Each of them is an abomination from each of those political philosophy positions. So how is it these mistakes become part of what our government does? Well, the political scientists are uncertain. They think this issue is a little bit complex. But here's the thing you know. You believe you know why in each of these cases the craziness was produced. All I had to do was to point to the money. And you believe you've discovered a root cause to the craziness. And here's my claim. Number one, it's because of cases like this that Americans believe that money buys results in Congress. In a poll I did for this book, 75% of Americans say, quote, money buys results in Congress. A little bit more Democrats than Republicans, but I guarantee you when the Democrats controlled Congress, the numbers were just the same. So whether it's two-thirds or three-fourths, here is the thing we all agree on. Money buys results in Congress. Number two, that belief erodes trust in this institution. Last year, Gallup found that 11% of Americans have confidence in Congress. Things have gotten better. It's now 12% of Americans that have confidence in Congress. We should put that in some context, right? There were more people who had faith in the British crown at the time of the revolution than who have faith in our Congress today. And that, of course, leads to number three. Low trust erodes participation in the political system. So Rock the Vote, the organization that registered and turned out more young voters in the last presidential election than had ever turned out in any presidential election before, and it was arguably responsible for the election of Barack Obama to the presidency, found that in 2010, many of their members were not going to vote, so they polled them. And the number one answer, by far, 2-1 over the second highest answer, for why they were not going to vote was, quote, no matter who wins, corporate interests will still have too much power and prevent real change. And it's not just kids who believe this. The vast majority did not vote in that election, in part because of precisely this belief. Okay, now, it was not supposed to be this way. The framers of our Constitution gave us what they called a republic, but what they meant by a republic was a, quote, representative democracy. And but they meant by a representative democracy, as Federalist 52 explains, is a democracy which would have a branch of government that would be, quote, dependent upon the people alone. Right, so here's the model of their government. You have the people, and then you have the government. I do my own slides. That's really cool, right, the way that bounces, right? The people and the government. And so the people have this marionette relationship to the government. The dependency is clear and simple. The problem is that Congress has evolved a different dependence, not just a dependence upon the people, but increasingly a dependence upon the funders. As members spend between 30 and 70% of their time raising money to get back to Congress or to raise the money so that their party can get back to power, they develop, as any of us would develop, a sixth sense, a constant awareness about how what they do might affect their ability to be able to continue to raise money. In the words of the X-Files, they become shapeshifters. As they adjust themselves to those positions they need to adopt in order to raise money, not in the top 10 issues that might have been discussed in their election or of importance to their constituents, but on an issue 11 to 1,000, where nobody knows and nobody cares except the lobbyists who play the role of channeling the money that guarantees them the resources they need to get back to office or to pay their dues to their own party. Leslie Byrne describes that when she went to Congress, she was told by a colleague, quote, "always lean to the green." Then to clarify, she went on, "he was not an environmentalist." Now, the obvious point is this, too, is a dependence. But it is a different and conflicting dependence from the dependence upon the people alone. Because, this should be obvious, the funders are not the people. They are two separate classes. Right? So if you ask the question, who is the most important class of funders of campaigns? It's those who max out in a congressional campaign. 0.05% of Americans maxed out in a congressional campaign in 2010. 0.05. So the Occupy Wall Street movement has this very dramatic, we are the 99%. Bad marketing, bad marketing. They are the 99.95% who has never maxed out in a political campaign and therefore has nothing like the access and influence that the funders have. Now, this is, and this should be obvious, though it's not obvious to our Supreme Court yet, this is corruption. It is not the corruption of brown paper bags secreting cash among members of Congress. That was the practice of Congress for much of the 19th century, well into the 20th century, when they had safes in their office to keep that cash. But in this sense of corruption, I think our Congress is the cleanest Congress in the history of Congress. It is not bribery or criminal law. It's not Rob Blagojevich-type behavior that I'm talking about here. This is a different kind of corruption. It is a corruption of the intended dependence that our framers had for our government. A government to be dependent upon the people alone is corrupted if, in addition to its dependence upon the people, it has a dependence on an independent and conflicting source like the funders. It is dependence corruption, the wrong dependence which constitutes it as a corruption. Now, we have to change this. We have to fix this dependence. If the problem here is that the funders are not the people, then the solution is to make the funders the people. The solution is to give them away. I know that looks like one word. I don't mean to give Congress away. That's two words. Let's give them a way to fund without Faust, to fund without selling their souls, and without alienating America because America believes it's just money that's buying results. And one way to do this, and I increasingly believe the only way to do this, is to embrace a principle that's been around for 85 years, to publicly fund these public elections. To move from a large dollar funded campaigns to small dollar funded campaigns. Following the model of states like Arizona or Maine or Connecticut, where candidates opt into a system where they limit their contributions to small dollar contributions only, and the system, the publicly funded election system, amplifies those contributions in a way that it makes it possible for them to fund their campaigns successfully without spending the time raising the money from the 0.05% of America. Now, there are many ways to do this. My particular proposal that I describe in my book is different from the proposal in Arizona and Maine and Connecticut, slightly. I think it's better, but, you know, I would say that, wouldn't I? But the point is, regardless of whichever small-dollar-funded system you embrace, here's the thing to focus on. If we had a Congress where the vast majority, let's say 70%, was elected by taking small-dollar contributions only, small-dollar contributions funding their elections exclusively, no PAC money, only small dollar contributions. Then we could believe, as we all want to believe, that when they did something stupid, it was either because there were too many Democrats or too many Republicans, but the one thing you wouldn't think is the one thing we all think now. You wouldn't think it was because of the money, because the essential condition for mistrust had been removed. Okay, now this is a way to restore the dependence intended by our framers, to restore it, and to possibly give Congress a chance to beat out old King George. All right, now, that's the argument. Here's the hard part. How do we get there? So I don't think it's hard to describe the problem. I don't think it's hard to describe a solution. What's hard here, indeed, I think maybe impossibly hard, is to imagine how we could bring the solution about. What is the political movement that could achieve this change? And that's impossibly hard because of an insight given to me by one of Congress's most senior members, Jim Cooper, who has been in Congress as long as all but about 20 other members of Congress, a Democrat from Tennessee, who explained to me in an interview I had with him about Congress that the problem with Capitol Hill is that Capitol Hill has become a, quote, farm league for K Street. Members and staffers and bureaucrats have this increasingly common business model, a model focused on their life after government, their life as lobbyists. Public Citizen calculated between 1998 and 2004, 50% of senators left to become lobbyists, 42% of members of the House. Those numbers have only gone up. This increasingly becomes a system where everybody depends upon the system surviving. That's the only way in which they have high-paying jobs to go to after their government service. And so in a world where all of the policymakers depend upon the system staying as it is, how do we ever imagine changing that system? So in my book, I describe four ideas. One of them is the ordinary way that we change policy. I think it's also an impossible way to change policy in the current system through an ordinary statute. No statute by this Congress will ever fundamentally change the system because of Congress's deep interest in keeping the system as it is. So that leads me to three insane ideas for changing the system, which I think are just improbable, not impossible. And the one I focus on most extensively is the idea of calling upon our framers' design in Article 5 of the Constitution, the article that governs amending the Constitution. That article presumed that Congress would propose the amendments. But in the convention, someone said, what if Congress is the problem? So they created an alternative path to amending the Constitution. And the alternative path was that the states could call on Congress to create a convention. And the convention would propose the amendments that then would have to be ratified like any other amendment by three-fourths of the states, 38 states passing the amendment. So this convention process is a way around the bottleneck that Congress might become. Now, all three of these insane ideas are always around what I think of as this cancer that is life within the Beltway. And the key here that this way around strategy should suggest is that it's not going to be possible right now to rely upon these ordinary means for achieving this change. Ordinary means aren't possible in these extraordinary times. Instead, right now, it requires that we do something that we've actually not done for a very long time, to build a kind of politics that is different from this politics, the politics of the passive, consuming, read-only citizen. It requires, instead, that we build a kind of active and engaged politics, which is ours and not the politicians'. Now, I don't actually think we know whether it's possible to do this. There's not a lot of evidence that we can. But I do think we know how this kind of politics starts. And it starts with two elements. Number one, with a certain clarity. It starts with the clarity of Thoreau. It starts with the clarity of a root striker. So I was just in Seattle. Seattle is, not surprising, has the greatest website for their Occupy Seattle movement. But if you go to the demands of the Occupy Seattle group, you see this endless list of demands that are being debated and voted upon, which are to signal what this movement is about. Everything from protecting the environment to, my favorite, ending the industrial prison complex. Now, the point is, this endless list of demands functions as kind of noise in the system. This doesn't say anything clearly. It just says things loudly, like fingers scraping on a blackboard. And I think what we need is to learn how to celebrate the diversity of our citizens, the diversity of people on the left versus people on the right, and to insist everyone stick to their principles, no compromise on whether you believe in progressive taxes versus flat taxes. I'm not saying anybody needs to compromise on those principles, but we need to find a way to seek common ground among people with fundamentally different views about what is the good. So these movements, these Occupy movements, should enter an exercise where they write three lists. Number one, we on the left believe the following. Number two, we on the right believe the following. But most important, is there a box we, all of us, believe that represents the ideas that could actually unite people from across these different groups? Now, I believe that if you focus on all the issues that concern us and learn to connect the dots, whether it's the left's concern about healthcare reform or the right's concern about bailouts, or the left's concern about global warming or the right's concern about complex taxes, or the left's concern about financial reform, or the right's concern about financial reform, regardless of the issue, if you focus and connect the dots, you will see this root cause. And this is the picture of this root cause. And what the clarity is that we need is the clarity of a root striker to teach all of us this root cause and unite us behind the idea of changing it, to get we the people to see this source. And second, we need a certain kind of courage. So Arne Hyatt is a Massachusetts resident, very humble guy. This is the biggest picture I could find of him on the internet. He was the president of StrideRight, which of course made great shoes like the Keds shoes. He is also a loyal Democrat. 1996, he was the second largest contributor to the Democratic Party. So Bill Clinton invited him and a bunch of other large contributors to a dinner at the Mayflower Hotel. So it was a dinner of these fat cats who were to sit around and tell the president what the president should do in the remaining part of his second term. We don't have any pictures of the evening. Everybody got up and spoke. Arne was the last one to speak. I kind of envision it like this. He stands up and he looks the president straight in the eye, and he says, "Mr. President, I know you're an admirer of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So I want you to put yourself in Roosevelt's shoes in 1940. When Roosevelt reluctantly came to recognize that he needed to convince a reluctant nation to wage a war to save democracy. Because he said, Mr. President, you too have to convince a reluctant nation to wage a war to save democracy. Not a war against fascists, but a war in a certain sense against we fat cats. A war against people who believe that merely because they are rich, they are entitled to direct government policy. Merely because they've been successful in the marketplace, they're entitled to get the president on the other end of the phone. People who have convinced America that democracy does not work." Now, as you can imagine, in that room of 30 fat cats and the president, after Arne spoke, a little bit of uncomfortable silence. The only published account of the evening says that after he spoke, Clinton's response effectively slashed Hyatt to pieces, humiliating him in front of the group. Now, I think 14 years later, what we need to do is to recognize that it was Arne Hyatt who was right that evening. We do have to convince a reluctant nation to wage a war to save democracy. But where Arne Hyatt was wrong was in his belief that politicians would wage that war. It won't be politicians. It will be citizens. It will be us. It will be root strikers. It will be you. It is our job. It requires our courage because it's our republic. It's our republic here that has been lost. Ours, not theirs. They took it away, but only because we let them take it away. I want to end with one final story. I'm sure many of you remember this tragic event in 1989 when a ship under the command of Captain Joseph Hazelwood ran aground in Prince William Sound and spilled about 11 million gallons of oil. This is Captain Hazelwood calling in the accident. If you want, so you're notified, over. Now, as might suggest to some of you, there was a question about whether Captain Joseph Hazelwood was intoxicated when he was captaining that supertanker. He said he wasn't. He said he'd only had about 4 vodkas before he got on the ship. Blood alcohol said he must have been at least 6 times the legal limit when he climbed aboard the ship. He denied it. His lawyers fought it. In the end, there was no conviction against him for that event. So maybe there's some doubt about whether Hazelwood was drunk. But what there was no doubt about was that he had a problem with alcohol. His mother testified. She knew he had a problem with alcohol. Exxon in 1985, 4 years before the accident, had treated him for his problem with alcohol. After the accident, the president of Exxon said he thought he had mastered the problem, but in 1986, he had had his driver's license revoked for a DUI, and in 1988, he had had his driver's license revoked for a DUI. At the time he was captaining a supertanker, he was not allowed to drive a VW Beetle. But I want you to forget about Hazelwood. I want you to instead think about those around Captain Hazelwood, the other officers, people who could have picked up a phone. While a supertanker, drunk was driving a supertanker, people who did nothing, because all except one of the officers did nothing. What do we think about them? Now, I ask that question because as I think about these issues, I increasingly think that we are they. Our society faces these critical problems requiring serious attention, but we have these institutions incapable of that attention, distracted, unable to focus, like pilots playing on their laptop instead of flying a plane, or a surgeon flirting rather than performing surgery, half of you on your cell phones when driving down the highway. These critical problems face our society requiring serious attention, but none of the institutions we have are capable of that attention. And who is to blame for that? Who is responsible? I don't think we can let the blame lie solely with the Rob Blagojeviches in the story. Solely with the evil people in the story. Instead, we need to think about the good people, the decent people, the people who could have picked up a phone, us. We, the most privileged, are obligated to fix it. Because the most outrageous part of this story is that the corruptions here might have been primed by the most privilege. But they were permitted by the passivity of the most privileged as well. Permitted. When Franklin was carried from the Constitutional Convention, he was asked by a woman on the street, "Mr. Franklin, what have you wrought?" And Franklin's reply was, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." A republic. A representative democracy. A government dependent upon the people alone. We have lost that republic. And it's our job to act to get it back. Thank you very much.
Well, good evening. My name is Don Polden, Dean of Santa Clara's Law School. And
sorry.
That's all right. I didn't even get to the punchline yet on that part. It's a great pleasure for me to serve as a moderator during this period of time. And let me again thank you, or ask you to thank Professor Lessig here for a very powerful and informative presentation. I've received a few cards already, questions, and I thought I would start through those. If you have some, please give them to some folks, and they'll bring them up, and we'll try and get them posed to Professor Lessig, if possible. First one I have is a question that you have suggested that the Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement or group unite in some fashion. Would you care to comment on that idea or thought?
Yeah, it turns out to be a harder idea for people to get than I thought it would be. So let me try again carefully. So I wrote a piece in the Huffington Post, and the basic structure was, look, I'm a liberal. I have very strong liberal views. I don't want to compromise on those liberal views. I'm tired of liberals compromising on their liberal views. So nothing I'm going to say is about taking our views and compromising on them. But if the Occupy movement is going to be something more than just 20% of America screaming loudly and forcefully in the name of their views, it has to mature into a movement that can try to identify common complaints that link left and right. So as I said, you might not believe in capitalism. I believe in capitalism. I'm a free market person, even though I'm a liberal. It doesn't seem contradictory to me, but to some, okay. But I believe in capitalism. But nobody believes in crony capitalism. And the system we've got right now, the corruption of the system we've got right now, is best described as a kind of crony capitalism. And people on the right can be as upset about that corruption as people on the left. And so my view is, if there is a way for these movements, these fundamental populist movements, to hold firm to what they believe in the substantive views about what the world should be and how a government should work, but recognize that there's an opportunity to link and overcome what is the procedural block to our government working, the thing that all of us believe, that money is buying results in Congress, that this corruption has gone too far, and do something about that corruption, we could get back to the place where we can have our fights about what policies win in the democratic process, and have faith in the outcome of that process. Now, we have a history that begins with exactly that kind of understanding. You know, 224 years ago, our framers sat, 74 of them sat in a hot room in Philadelphia. And we kind of think of those guys as all the same. White, they wore the same clothes, they must have had the same view. But they had fundamentally different views, right? There are people in that room who believed in slavery, and people who believed that slavery was the moral abomination of the age. And yet they were able to bracket that fundamental disagreement long enough to build a republic within which
those views and others could be worked out. It took too long to work out slavery, but there were lots of issues that they could work out and save this nation. Now, you know, as someone from the left, this might surprise people, but, you know, there is no difference between the left and the right in America as profound as the difference between those who believed in slavery and those who don't. And we don't have to build a whole government. We just have to fix one important and obvious flaw in the existing government. So our problem is, in an important sense, smaller, and our differences are less profound, and we should be able to find a way around the differences enough to get to a place that we could bring about the change that would actually make it possible for this democracy to work again.
Perfect. Thank you. Another question from your book, which I would recommend. I've had an opportunity to read it, and I would recommend it to all of you. Your criticism of President Obama is quite noticeable in the book. My characterizations would be missed opportunities, kind of business as usual. You pay him kind of a backhanded compliment that Bush was worse in terms of what happened on his watch. In your opinion, what should President Obama have done to have taken advantage of those opportunities and produce something more noteworthy?
Yeah, so, I mean, let's be clear. I was a very strong supporter of the president. I had supported every single one of his campaigns. He was a colleague of mine at Chicago. I had known him. I considered him a friend. But the only reason I think he had a claim to the nomination over Hillary Clinton was that he said the problem was exactly the corruption I'm talking about here. He said we need to take up the fight to change the way Washington works. And he said if we don't take up that fight, then the problems our children will face will be exactly the problems that we face and every generation will face because the lobbyists have their way of blocking reform inside the system. So he defined what was different about him from Clinton. Indeed, a number of times he said, this is the reason I am running, to do this change. He defined himself in precisely this reformatory way. But when he became president, all of that was forgotten. Indeed, I don't even think they had a plan in place for how they were going to bring about the change that they promised. So I think what he should have done was what he said he was going to do, to focus the nation on the need to make the democracy work. And had he, I just heard the story from inside the administration, apparently when the first budget was given to him, it had some 7,000 earmarks in it, and the president's first response was, I'm going to veto this budget. And then his lobbyists from Capitol Hill said, no, you can't veto this budget. And you just kind of imagine what would the administration have looked like if from the very beginning he had taken this strong stand for reform. He would have been the Tea Party. He would have been the person that continued the vision I think many people hoped, I certainly hoped, of the man who was going to go to Washington and change Washington. But instead, he adopted the framework of many of the Clinton advisors who said, this is the way you run presidencies. You just strike as many deals as you can. And it turned out, you know, he doesn't get a fraction of what he thought he was going to get when he plays that kind of game. So I think it was a fundamental mistake. I'm quite harsh on him, and I've gotten a lot of angry responses for my harshness. And of course, you know, I want him. I'm a Democrat, so I want him to win over all but one Republican. So the one Republican I would vote for over Barack Obama is Buddy Romer. Of course, you've never heard of Buddy Romer, but. Okay. Buddy Romer is he's a former governor from Louisiana, four-term congressman, ran a bank for 20 years. Buddy Romer has promised to take no more than $100 from anybody, take no PAC money, and disclose every single contribution. His whole campaign is focused on the ability of a president to be, quote, free to lead. But of course, you know, the policy wonks say anybody who commits to taking no more than $100 just can't win, so write him off from the very beginning, even though in some sense he's had more experience than any of the other candidates he's written off from the beginning. So he is the one Republican I would vote for, even though substantively there are many things I don't believe in. But the idea of somebody from the right who would be pushing these kinds of reforms is too tempting for me. So I hope Obama, you know, assuming Buddy is not the candidate, I hope Obama wins. But it is an enormous disappointment, because of all the people who could have brought about this change, January 20, 2009, that man walked on water. He had a supermajority in Congress. He could have united the people behind this essential change in the middle of a crisis and done something, and he didn't.
I have a couple questions that are loosely hinged around the idea of a constitutional amendment. One asks you to talk a little bit more about your thoughts for calling for a constitutional convention, and the other one asks what would we ask for that, in other words, what changes to the Constitution are required to enable the reforms you advocate.
So I think that if I could write the amendment tomorrow that should be added to the Constitution, it would have essentially three substantive parts. Number one, it would mandate public elections have to be publicly funded. Number two, it would limit contributions to the equivalent of $100. Just take Buddy's number. And number three, it would give Congress the power to limit, but not to ban, independent expenditures by individuals as well as corporations. So I think it's important to limit and not to ban, because I think everybody in the political system ought to have the ability to put their issue out there and make people understand it. You know, I think that's an extremely important part of the process, and no entity simply because of their identity should be blocked from that. But what we have to avoid is an election where candidates are not only shape-shifting to please their contributors, but they're shape-shifting to please the independent expenditures that, as we've seen since the Citizens United decision, are exploding in our political system and exploding in a way we didn't even know. You know, the Supreme Court assumed that all of these independent expenditures were going to be transparent, but took a comedian to teach America that, in fact, they're not transparent. We don't know anything about who's giving because there's a huge loophole through which anonymous contributions can go. And so so that would be the substance of the change. Now, I also think there is zero chance. I looked it up on Google. Zero, exactly zero chance that the United States Senate would ever propose such an amendment to the states for all the reasons I went. So if you're not going to do it in the ordinary path, then we think about a convention. We think about a convention which requires 34 states, two-thirds of the states, to call for one. The interesting political opportunity is that states don't have to call for a convention for the same reason. So conservatives are already pushing for a convention to get a balanced budget or to limit the total debt. Other people could be pushing for a convention for different reasons, including like ending the corruption of our political system. So you could get lots of different people that want the convention for different reasons. Then you have a convention that deliberates and proposes amendments that then have to be ratified in the regular way. Now, but here's the really crazy part to the idea. I mean, it's insane enough to talk about a convention, but here's really super insane part of the idea. I agree with Sandy Levinson from Texas that the delegates to that convention ought to be like a civil jury. They ought to be randomly selected people from the populace. Now, that sounds crazy until you look at really important equivalent experiments. So you guys experimented with the California Forward movement that took a deliberative poll of 300 citizens from California and had them work through important questions about what California should do in their equivalent crisis. And I think that if we ran a series of these, like 20 or 30 of these mock conventions, where we created equivalent deliberative polls and randomly selected people and gave them the information and had them think about it, we would learn that politics is that rare sport where the amateur is better than the professional. Because the professional is professional at focusing on the special interests that the professional has been elected to represent. And the amateur, I've run some of these deliberative polls, I've seen how this works, you kind of call into life a being. It's called the citizen. If you put them in the right context and give them the right information, and they start talking in a way that is extraordinarily inspiring, even to an elitist Harvard Law professor like me. So I have enormous faith in how that process could produce sanity. And I think it's essential, because as California struggled when it was thinking about its own constitutional convention, if the only thing a convention was like normal politics, like the politicians were going to be at the convention or you had elections, and it would be a disaster because, of course, the same problems would just replicate themselves there. So I want a convention of ordinary citizens who are given the chance to think about our problems and propose solutions that are meaningful in light of what they've been shown, and that, I think, is a powerful way around the block. Now, here's the critical point, though. You don't even have to get to the convention for it to have an effect. The last time we came close to a convention was when the question in America's mind was whether we should have an elected Senate to replace the appointed Senate that the framers gave us. And Congress wouldn't propose this amendment. So as the framers thought, if Congress was the problem, then we have to go to the states. So when they got within one vote of the states calling for a convention, Congress was terrified. And it therefore quickly sent out an amendment to effectively stop the convention movement by offering to change itself. I think the same opportunity exists here. If we can get close to a convention, Congress begins to be terrified. Oh, my gosh, these amateur politicians getting together and talking about how to change our government. It shouldn't be allowed. And then they will do whatever they can to stop it. And what they can do to stop it is to give us at least some of what we want, a government we can trust. And that would be fine second best to me.
A few of our audience members here are very interested in the fat cats. And so a couple of questions here about who the biggest lobbyists are in Capitol Hill and how do they function, how do they work. And I thought I'd put a little spin on that about whether they exhibit or suffer from the same sort of corruption that you mentioned, a dependency corruption that you mentioned legislators do, congressional people.
Congress has a very tight relationship to this army of lobbyists. Much more money is spent on lobbyists than is spent on congressional campaigns. And the lobbyists, I think, play an essential role. You know, even in my utopia, we still have lobbyists. But as John Edwards used to say when we used to quote John Edwards, there's all the difference in the world between a lawyer making an argument to a jury and a lawyer handing out $100 bills to the jurors. And the problem with our lobbying system is there is no such distinction. They are both the providers of essential information and the conduits through which too much campaign funding happens. And so a member of Congress can listen to the argument and say, that's a ridiculous argument, but can't say it out loud because it threatens the opportunity to continue to be the beneficiary of this funding stream. So in a certain sense, the lobbyists are playing their role. It's an essential role. We've just got to change that role. And I think if we change that role, then they can provide information in the old-fashioned way. When you started this question, though, I thought you were going to ask a harsher, meaner question, so I appreciate you didn't. But let me answer the harsher, meaner question about fat cats. You know, I mean, I had 9 glorious years out here. And when I saw the Occupy Wall Street movements happen, I kind of thought to myself, could there have been an Occupy Silicon Valley movement? And, of course, it's laughable, right? It's laughable. Because even though there's wealth out here, you don't have the sense that the wealth out here has been produced in the same way the wealth in Wall Street has been produced. Right? You don't have the anger. Nobody would stand outside of, you know, one infinity way and say, that's Steve Jobs. I know there are those people. But, the point is, this has been extraordinary production of wealth in the way we think wealth ought to be produced. And in Wall Street, the complaint is they were in bed with the lobbyists who were in bed with the congressmen that created a set of rules that were insane and made it so that they can make all the money, and when everything failed, they got bailed out by the government, right? That is the complaint. And so when you criticize wealth, and I think the Occupy movement has got to do this more clearly, it's not wealth you should be criticizing. It is wealth produced in this corrupt way. And out here, I mean, I spent 9 years out here trying to get people in this movement for reform, and so many of the people out here are like, oh, geez, I don't want to have to think about government. Government's a total waste of time, and it's complete idiots, and I just want to work on my code. Well, you know, if you do that for too long and you don't think about these problems and you don't figure out how we're going to stop this, then you can be thinking about your code while the rest of the world goes down the toilet, because we can't not solve that problem. And the essential insight and virtue and values to solve it comes from out here. So that's why I'm spending an enormous part of this book promotion out here, because I think this part of the country is an essential part to the solution to this problem.
Well, we're going to go back to work as lawyers here. I have a couple questions in this area. One asks you how you counter the argument in Citizens United case that even people with money have the right to spend their money on what they wish and say what they want publicly. And the other one, tracking the same one, is looking at cases from Buckley versus Vallejo to Citizens United. The emphasis in those cases was on the First Amendment freedom of expression associated with campaign contributions. And are you confident that the changes you suggest would survive constitutional review by the Supreme Court?
So the change that I suggest in public funding, the proposal that I describe in my book, absolutely survives this, even this Supreme Court. There's nothing in my description of public funding that the Supreme Court has ever hinted it would have a problem with. So that part is safe. But Congress doesn't have the power under the current First Amendment jurisprudence to limit contributions to $100 or to limit independent expenditures. And so that would require a constitutional amendment. Now, that begs the question, does that amendment violate free speech principles? And I don't think it does if it's understood in the way I've tried to describe it. And that is, Buckley versus Vallejo, the very first case talking in this space, recognized that an essential component to the right of the government to limit people's ability to speak was that that speaking created the impression that the government was corrupt. The appearance of corruption was a critical part of the analysis. And I think what we should take recognition of is, even though we don't have Rob Blagojevich corruption throughout our system, the system for funding elections that we have produced right now has led people to believe this system is corrupt. Now, you could believe it's not corrupt, and you can write the book to prove it. I believe it is corrupt, and I've written the book to prove that. But whether you're right or I'm right, the fact is people believe it. And that is a critical fact to respond to, because if people believe it, they don't respond in the appropriate way. I mean, for example, you know, the other part of my life, I'm running the Center for Ethics, and we're studying institutional corruption generally, and that is this problem across every field. So you see this everywhere. You know, academics taking money to give public testimony, doctors taking money to sit on panels that review drugs. But in some areas, it's quite profound, the cost of this mistrust. So, you know, there's all this skepticism around vaccines. And some of the skepticism is produced because the very people approving the vaccines have ties to the companies that benefit from the vaccines. Now, whether rational or not, there are people who then think, when I'm told to give my child a vaccine, it's not because it's a good thing to do, it's because the money. I don't believe that. I think it's completely bogus to make that argument. But if people believe that, if parents believe that, and they choose not to vaccinate their kids, then measles rises, as we've seen it rise, and all sorts of deadly diseases spread throughout our society. And I think that is a sufficient reason, parents' reaction, to adjust the way we fund doctors and fund research so that people have a reason to trust it. And I think that's the same point here. People are going to be free to speak. I said limit, don't ban, so corporations can put up their pages in the Wall Street Journal saying these policies are stupid. But they just can't dominate the system so much that we look at a politician and we say, the only reason you're saying that is you know oil money is going to go against you if you don't say that.
Well, we've just about run out of time, and we have time for just one last question. And I selected one that is kind of targeted in a way. And it asks you if you could give...
no more time, sorry.
Pardon me?
No more time.
If you could give the 99.95% an idea of one specific demand to make of government or Wall Street, what would that one specific demand be?
Oh, that's an easy question. Right? To end this corruption, right? The one specific demand is to organize behind the idea of ending precisely the corruption that I'm talking about. And you end that corruption, and we get back to the world where people can actually engage in a way about politics and have faith in that engagement. So I think that is the critical thing that we have to develop a recognition on the right and the left to support.
Wonderful. Thank you, Doctor. You want to wrap it?
Well, I hope you all have enjoyed this evening's program. It was part of the Geschke Family Lecture Series on the Constitution and hosted by the Markola Center for Applied Ethics and the Commonwealth Club of California. Again, I think it's appropriate to give a round of applause to thank Professor Lessig for his incredible presentation. I'd also like to thank our moderator, Donald Poland, the Dean of the Santa Clara University School of Law, and I'd like to thank all of you as well as our audience out on the Internet and on the web. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.